Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I am your host, as always, Matthew Miranda. In this present darkness, we will look at the NBA's ongoing play-in and imminent playoffs. After this opening segment, which will be a little bit shorter, you'll hear my interview with Chris Persiainen. Chris is a rising young media sports media figure. He covers the Knicks for WFUV. He also, as you'll hear, when I interview him, he's the co-host of All Things NBA from A to Z podcast. He hosts the Draft Class pod also at Knicks Film School. He is a month away from graduating from Fordham University. Fordham for sports media is like what Kentucky is for men's college basketball, or South Carolina is for women's college basketball. Like, there is just a pantheon of sports media figures who've come out of Fordham, and Chris is rising like a bullet on that list. So I wanted to talk to him about his thoughts and things that he feels and sees about, you know, sports media today, things that he sees that he'd like to see change, things that he sees that, you know, maybe he hopes are still around when he gets to a position of greater prominence. But I just thought, this dude's half my age and like is about to jump into it. I wonder what that's like. I wonder what he thinks and sees about things. So his interview will come up right after this. The Jacobin Sports Show is a salt of the earth kind of program. So if you are morally watching your sodium intake, just be aware that Chris does use the F word with some frequency. But it's a good interview. Stay tuned for that. But first, before all of that, when is disappointment fulfilling? I will tell you. I'm working right now in my life outside of sports podcasting and sports media on a Medusa project, using the Medusa myth for a nonfiction kind of thing that I'm working on. So I've been doing a lot of research on her and her story and her background, and I have discovered in that Medusa was related to like an entire litter of monsters, like mythological monsters that I did not know she was connected to. She's related to the Hydra. These are all like siblings of hers. The Hydra is related to Medusa. Cerberus is related to Medusa. The Sphinx, the Caucasian Eagle, that's the dude that eats Prometheus's liver like every day. Her aunt is Styx, who the river is named after. Styx, the entity, was the personification of hatred. Like, this is a monstrous, monstrous family that Medusa comes out of. And the irony in all that, and something I'm going to explore in the story, is that if you know Medusa's story, she's very much been slandered and miscast as a monster. But of all those creatures, not one of those abominations is as unholy as Barcelona Football Club, who's come from a head loss in the second leg and over both legs of their Champions League quarterfinals to Paris Saint-Germain, was a win for all mankind. And first, I want to apologize to all the viewers who have memories of Jonah Birch speaking French. I did not take French. All the French I learned was probably from like Looney Tunes. I remember the first time on the show Jonah pronounced Paris Saint-Germain the way that he says it, and like I could have just listened to him say that on a loop. Like, the rest is so beautiful. So we miss you, Jonah. We miss your French. You may be thinking, wait, did you just say that it's a good thing for humanity that Barcelona lost to PSG, given that PSG is owned by Qatar, a country whose treatment of migrant workers, women, and the queer community is so disgusting and reviled, it stands out on a planet whose treatment of migrants, workers, women, and the queer community is disgusting? I come not, Romans, countrymen, I do not come today in praise of Qatar. It's more just that while Barcelona losing and certainly PSG winning don't actually move the moral needle anywhere closer to meaningful justice in this world, if two monsters are fighting and one ends up dead, you do have some reason to celebrate. That's one less monster in a world populated by entirely too many. Barcelona has been desperate to advance in the Champions League because they have major, I don't want to say major, they have financial limitations that have been imposed on them because the last few years they have had such issues with debt. I think it's like half a billion every year. They're in enormous debt every year. And as a result, over time, they've had their spending power cut somewhat. Part of what's annoying with Barcelona is, like you see anywhere else in the world, you know, because they're powerful and they're too big to fail, and they've basically been, along with Madrid, subsidized by the government versus the way teams in other countries maybe are, or even teams in Spain are. Barcelona, they have no money. And in this age of super European stringency and oversight and financial fair play, and I think what they call PSR now in England, with all we're checking every I and every T to make sure that every single team is in a financially compliant and safe state. Barcelona is constantly like a tsunami of debt, and yet every year they call it pulling a lever. They'll sell 25% of their media company, or they'll sell players who didn't want to go, players who came to Barcelona because they want to play in Barcelona, but the team makes it clear, like, well, no, you're gone. We need the money instead. And they're still able to bring in like top players from every year. They are able to add people, maybe not everyone that they want, but like they were able to add Ilkay Gundogan, who's one of the best players still in the top leagues of Europe. They're able to bring in Robert Lewandowski the other year, who's been, you know, who's a top level goal scorer. There's always, oh, Barca is interested in this person. Barca is going to bid on that person. They have no money, but this is what the Super League was, one expression of this, and Barcelona's reality is another one. You see, if it's an old power with a money problem, if it's too big to fail, too institutional with a money problem, there's a way that they manage. You know, it's like if you're rich and you're poor, it's not the same as if you're poor and you're poor. And you see teams like Everton right now in England, and Leicester City, and I think it's Nottingham Forest, maybe. There's a number of teams in England that are dealing with points deductions and possible significant financial ramifications that come with that, because they're not rich to begin with. Newcastle has basically been, you know, the perfect, all the recent rules that were designed to like shut the door and not let another Manchester City kind of team happen, another PSG happen. Newcastle is your case of like how that's working. Because Newcastle has all the money in the world to spend, but they're restricted because they weren't rich before. So they're held to these standards and levels and things that they have to hit and cross that the system is designed to keep them from doing. So every time I see Barcelona advancing, succeeding, celebrating, it's always just a punch in the gut for anyone who knows what it is to be like poor. And understand, like, rich poor is not the same thing. So, yeah, I'm going to take Barcelona losing as a W. But there's also another game that had an interesting kind of reflection. Manchester City, my team, played an incredible quarterfinal two legs against Real Madrid, two best teams in the world. City lost the second leg yesterday on penalty kicks. So Real advances, where they will go on to play Bayern Munich in one semifinal. In the other semifinal, it's Borussia Dortmund against PSG. So I might have told this story once on this show. Forgive me if I have. It's a short one. If you haven't heard it, I like to collect gems and fossils and coins and earth stuff. And one of the pieces that I'm happiest with earlier this year, I was able to get a piece of tanzanite. Tanzanite is one of the rarer minerals like on Earth. It's only found in a part of Tanzania where Kilimanjaro basically formed. Earth is about 200 million square miles of space. You can only get tanzanite in one, basically five kind of square mile area, and the whole planet, that's it. And it also has this really unique quality. It's called, I think, pleochroism, where if you hold a piece of tanzanite in your hand, like it looks just kind of like an unremarkable stone. If you hold it up to the light, depending what angle you hold it at, you will get three homogeneous but different colors. So you have a piece of tanzanite and you hold it up at one angle, it will give you purple. You turn the same stone to a slightly different facet or angle, it'll be this really pretty blue. And then if you turn it again, it's this really like stunning red. It's a remarkable jewel. It's a remarkable little piece. The game yesterday that City and Real played as a game was like a little beautiful piece of tanzanite. It was an incredible game. Real went up early. City, despite trailing for the majority of the game, were easily the better side the last 100 minutes or more. It was just wave after wave of City doing their possession tic-tac-toe, very, very patient approach, just like picking a lock, just waiting for the, and then cutting through. And then Real, who have incredible, incredible offensive talent. I mean, they have talent everywhere, but on the rare cases they get the ball, they always seem to be off and running with like three or four terrifying players all coming at your goalie. It's an amazing game. It went to penalty kicks. Real won. They deserved the win. City, I thought, were the better team on the day, but there's not another team on earth that would have held on the way that Real did. Like, City were coming wave after wave after wave, and Real were almost always like up to the task. There were a couple spots that, you know, in any game you miss, you regret it, but like Real deserved the win. City hadn't lost in over 4 months. This is the first major trophy that they're not going to win since 2022. I feel something I really never felt before, and that's probably because I've never had a team that was this good for this long. Usually if my teams ever win a title, that's it. They win one, and then, but City's been so good for so long. They played as well as they could play yesterday. They did everything you could ask for from a team. I feel today a complete sense of fullness and peace. I was not angry when the game was over. I was not even disappointed. Like, I was disappointed because I felt that they were better, but I didn't have that. Usually when your team loses and you're disappointed, there's some kind of burning in you. It's injustice or just incredible frustration. Like, I didn't feel any of that. I felt like I just spent hours getting exactly what you want. And what you want is, you think it's the win maybe, but it's not the win. Just, I really saw the absolute top people at the top level of a competition. I saw the best players in the world all playing as well and as hard as they could for the full game, and then in overtime, and then penalty kicks. And it was just incredible to watch and really, really good. If you cook and you use fish sauce and you understand how it creates umami in what you're making, that's what this game was. A lot of games, they have a flavor, but it's not that complete. Yesterday was tanzanite and fish sauce in all the best ways possible. Contrasting this wonderful sense of peace that I feel as a City fan is how I'm going to be feeling in about 56 hours maybe, when the Knicks begin their playoffs against the Philadelphia 76ers. The Knicks have not been the best team in the world the way City has been. So, and where I've seen City win everything, I've never seen the Knicks win. So I will not have this same, you know, just peaceful appreciation. I know what's coming. Speaking of knowing what's coming, the NBA has now had, in 2 days, 4 play-in games, and the league that opened the season by publicly insisting there is absolutely no correlation between players resting and players being healthier. Well, we've had 4 play-in games, and so far there have been 3 significant injuries in 3 different games. After an end of season where it seemed like there were more injuries than there usually are. This has happened. So first, and the really unfortunate, your heart goes out to the player and to the fans of the New Orleans Pelicans. In the last maybe 2 minutes, About 2 minutes left of the Pelicans' play-in game against the Lakers, Zion Williamson had just scored his 40th point. Game was tied. He was killing them. And he scored his last basket, and as soon as he landed, he was grimacing. And it turns out that he's injured. He's not going to be available for at least a few weeks, by which time the Pelicans will probably be gone because they ended up losing that game to the Lakers. And now have to play tonight, I believe, the second play-in game against Sacramento. The winner will be the eighth seed and open against Oklahoma City. But the Pelicans without Zion Williamson are not the same team. And it's really sad that a team that had a really strong year all year and that a lot of things finally seem to be coming together for, literally you're 2 minutes from getting where you're trying to get to, and now you're not, and your best player is gone, and you're looking at an elimination game. Similarly, in the other conference, the Miami Heat were saddened to hear that they will be without Jimmy Butler for at least, well, really for the rest of the, they're done. Jimmy Butler has an MCL issue. He injured it last night in their play-in loss to, good Lord, where's my brain? Philadelphia. He got hurt late. He got hurt in that game and kept playing on it for three quarters, which is interesting. And now he has an MCL issue and he's going to be gone the rest of the season. So now Miami will be hosting Chicago in the Eastern Conference game for the eighth seed for the right to be destroyed by Boston. Chicago is now without Alex Caruso, who got hurt in that same game last night. He has apparently a severe foot sprain. He's done for the year. So the Pelicans have lost their best player. The Heat have lost their best player. The Bulls have lost their best defender. The Bulls and the Heat, whoever win, are now going to go play against the Celtics down a significant piece, whether it's Butler or Caruso, which is not what either of those teams needs. Miami, a healthy Miami versus Boston is a very interesting series. A depleted Miami or a depleted Chicago, like the Celtics really just have to spend four games upright and they're going to win. And we heard all year and we heard at the start, load management doesn't matter. The NBA had their scientists, just like the NFL used to have their scientists who insisted, no, there's, how could there be a connection between violent physical contact and brain injuries? Nah, there can't be anything there. Well, the NBA tells you, no. Don't listen to your body. We're telling you, running around more, working harder does not make you more susceptible to, well, here we are. And perhaps even sadder than athletes suffering unnecessarily this way and fans suffering unnecessarily this way, we consider the Atlanta Hawks. The Hawks were eliminated last night from the play-in after surrendering 131 points to the Chicago Bulls. And no, if you look around, you will see I'm not talking about the days of the Chicago Bulls, you know, when that meant something. We're talking about the 2024 Chicago Bulls, who scored 131 points. Excellent game for Coby White. But the Atlanta Hawks, there's a famous Swedish scientist, theologian. I guess if he's famous, you don't need to say that. Named Emanuel Swedenborg from way, way, way back, centuries ago. And Swedenborg wrote a story. There's a coincidence to this story. Swedenborg once wrote a story about a man who is in hell, but he doesn't know that he's in hell. And his first day there, he's in his house. It's his house that he lived in his whole life. And the dude thinks he's alive, and it's just another day in his life. This goes on for weeks. Every day he wakes up, and he's just in his house. Has no, absolutely no idea that he's anywhere other than normal life. One day in the house, he notices that something is missing. He can't remember what it is. But things start slowly. Something will disappear from the house each day. Little thing, something you'd never notice until eventually it begins to accumulate. And obviously the momentum of the story is, you know, eventually he loses everything or enough that then it becomes clear you are not where you thought you were. You are in hell. This sounds to me a lot like what the Atlanta Hawks have been since 2021. 2021, you may recall, if you're a Knicks fan, you definitely recall, the Hawks beat the Knicks badly in the first round of the playoffs, a series that a lot of people thought would be competitive or that the Knicks would win because the Knicks had dominated Atlanta that regular season. But the Hawks crushed the Knicks, got to the next round, upset the heavily favored top seed Philadelphia 76ers, got to the next round, even without their best player for some of it, Trae Young. They took Milwaukee to six games. They were two wins from the finals, which is closer than Atlanta's ever been to the finals. Best year in franchise history. Young franchise player and young other great young players. Incredible. Whenever the Hawks are good, they have amazing fans. And since then, they're like the house in Swedenborg's Hell. Like, they haven't fallen off a cliff. You can't look at Atlanta now and say, oh, well, obviously they still have Trae Young. They still have Bogdan Bogdanovic, who was a great player for them 3 years ago, still is. They still have DeAndre Hunter. They still have Clint Capella. They still have Onyeka Okongwu. They still have so many of the pieces that they had from a couple years ago. It's not like there was a major fire sale, facelift, rebuild. It's a lot of the... And 3 years ago, this was the quintessential, like, wow, they can beat anybody. Like, they may never be the favorite, but everyone should be afraid of them because they got that knockout punch. And ever since then, they've lost like a little edge here and some stuff you might not notice there and a little hope now and again. And now you're left with just this sad, depleted recognition of, oh, the past really is behind us. We are in hell. Your 2024 Atlanta Hawks, people. That is all for this segment of today's Jacobin Sports Show. I will now do the close and then just stay tuned after that for the interview with Chris Percy-Einen. Happy to report we are now up to a record 11 Patreon subscribers. Thank you to all of you who have joined. My favorite number is the number 13. If we ever hit that level, I am going to do something very special for everyone who subscribes. Curious what that is? So am I, since I just thought of it. But if you're not a member yet, join the Jacobin Sports Show Patreon, Jacobin, and we will find out together. I leave you before the interview with a series of quotes since we talked about evil today. Three quotes about evil. One, the more one is absorbed in fighting evil, the less one is tempted to place the good in question. That from the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. Second quote, this is good. Life must continue. We are fighting barbarians, but we must remain human. That from David Benioff, I don't know how to pronounce his name, one of the Game of Thrones TV writer adapters. Also now has written Three Body Problem. Lastly, fighting evil by moonlight, winning love by daylight, never running from a real fight. She is the one named Sailor Moon. That's all for this episode. Peace, comrades. Today's guest is a sports reporter for WFUV Sports, including covering the highly coveted New York Knicks beat, the co-host of All Things NBA from A to Z, presented by Ball is Life, host of the Draft Class Pod at Knicks Film School, and the single greatest thing to come out of Fordham University since the queen of Pine Valley and Garden City herself, Susan Lucci, class of 68, Chris Percy-Einen. How are you doing today?
What's going on, man? Thank you so much for having me on. This is awesome.
Very excited to have you. You have been a Twitter celebrity in my life for many years, despite your youth. So this is very exciting for me. I'm very glad to have you on the Jacobin Sports Show today.
I will not lie, though, and I will say that there are too many Fordham sports media alum that I have now met that I can't even joke about not being insanely great. So like, we got to tour the Michael K show last week, like that. I will, you know, not so he gets it. Ruco Shackle, Barbari, like run the Yankees broadcasts. Breen, of course.
Breen, Eagle, Albert.
Little known fact, the Knicks PA announcer, Mike W.
Michael Chesky.
Fordham University. Not WFUV Sports, but he went to Fordham. So how about that?
You guys are everywhere. It's like the Red Scare. I love this. So let's dive into your a bit into your Fordham dual identity as a student and a media member. I want to know, first of all, what is something that exists in sports media today that you hope, like, is your ambition? Like, you, it's not on your radar now, but one day, like, it's your Hall of Fame, it's your name in the rafters. Like, what's the number one thing you can think of right now that exists that, like, man, I want to be on that, doing that someday?
I want to be on television or radio talking and analyzing sports, or I want to be in a front office, you know, like maybe I've always thought like the Bobby Marks path, yes. Maybe but in reverse. So like the Mike Schmitz path would be like a dream of mine, like going from, hey, I'm a schmuck who yells about sports online, to, hey, this team pays me to yell about sports, and then they make decisions based off my yelling. That's a super egotistical sentence, but
it's a great Machiavellian confession you just made here, Chris.
That's how I want the validation that people think I'm good at what I do, and that comes with an audience. Or it comes with a job. But like, to me, I don't care about the size of the audience. Like, if 5 people watch my show and they think it's great, I'm so happy.
Yeah.
But if the audience was an NBA governor who was like, hey, make draft decisions, or like be a pro scout, that would be super cool. But in sports media, talk show radio host, I mean, I would love to talk football, baseball too. You know, like I would totally... Like the Michael K show, like I mentioned earlier, like that would be a dream gig, having my own radio show with buddies that, you know, we play silly drops, but we also get to like talk about serious topics. The day we went, they talked about Ohtani and Ipe. It was the day OJ Simpson died, and they talked Knicks, Mets, Yankees. Like Bomani Jones is someone who I really look up to, because he's consistently getting himself in situations where he can talk about his takes on sports and his takes on how those sports things are kind of microcosms of the real world, if that makes sense. I would love that. Like anything where I can live basketball and sports, I would love to do. And I think the self-publishing aspect of today's media world is how I am where I am right now, but also just super different than how things used to be.
Is there a challenge ever for you balancing, like, the nature of sports media involves, like you're saying, like it's number, you need number to some extent, like you need someone listening, and depending where you want to go, you might need many of the people listening, and there's countless external metrics to decide how you're doing. But to do the work, which can often be very, very lonely, if you're writing, you're recording, like it's not always what people are seeing. There's a lot that goes on behind it. Is it a challenge ever for you having to balance the work requires external validation in order to keep the ball rolling, but I have to be internally driven regardless of what's happening externally to keep it going? Because there's a lot of periods of, like, if you're going by what you're getting, you would stop.
I have raging ADHD, and as a result, I have this motor inside me that at random times activates and compels me to optimize every second of that period of time during which that motor is on. Last night I covered the Knick game. There was a day game. After that, I went straight to a nice place in Harlem. I really like French food in Harlem with my girlfriend. And we got home and she knocked out by 9:30. And from 9:30 to 3:30 in the morning, I edited my beat report from the Knick game, posted it on YouTube, edited a podcast for Ball is Life, did a homework assignment. Like, I'm an only child with like crazy ADHD. I've been my own motivator my entire life. It's not lonely because I love it. is this a swearing show?
Absolutely.
I fucking love this shit, dude. Like, I fucking cannot get enough. When I'm in Delaware with my family in the summer, I remember when I was working for Sports Illustrated, I would be hanging out with my family from 5 to 10, all my Dominican cousins down there having a great time, dessert at 10 p.m. And then after dessert, you mix rum chata and Fireball and it tastes like Cinnamon Toast Crunch and fucking then after that, my cousins and I would hang out from like 11 to 2. And then at 2, I would go back and until 4 or 5, write my article that would be published at 8 on deadline. Yeah, so, like, yeah. I love this shit. I can't get enough.
It really works for you.
I cannot get enough. If it was staying up all night watching tape, taking notes, it would not feel like a job. If it was staying up all night editing TikTok videos for a social channel, it would not feel like a job. If it was staying up all night painstakingly editing an article or re-recording video takes, I think sadly for some really talented people, the written word is like dead as fuck. And you're one of them, so sorry, but your recaps are amazing, but buddy, get ready to get a DSLR. Everything's gonna be video, everything's gonna be streaming. Like, dude, fucking take a look at Disney Plus. They just reinvented cable. Did you see what they announced today? There's going to be channels on Disney Plus, a Marvel channel, a Star Wars channel, and all day it just plays Marvel shit or Star Wars shit. Like, they're reinventing everything that has already happened, except it's because people love just like giving up their control to the universe. Like, oh, the universe brought this into my life. It's a sign. You don't have to sit and choose to read a book when you can just watch and get sucked into your screen. I want to be someone who people don't feel like they're getting sucked into watching. Like, I want someone to wake up and be like, oh my God, I cannot believe these two players got in a fight in this NBA game last night and they both got ejected. What does Chris think about this? Like, I want someone to see Victor Wembanyama's younger brother have a 6-inch growth spurt at the age of 15 and be like, I wonder if Chris thinks this kid is legit. And those are like kind of like my selfish, egotistical motivators. But my own personal motivators are I want to have a take on those things. I don't want to have a take on things I don't know about. I don't want to be someone who says, he's a good running back. But I just, you know, I don't know that at the pro level. Like, I just want to talk what I know and passionately and for the purpose of, hey, I have fun doing this. Have fun with me. Call into my show. I love Nick's Film School Study Hall because we do like little like 5-10 minute diatribes each to start. And then we bring up callers and they just ask questions and we field them. It's like, it's the best to talk sports with people. Sports are made to unite people, as I enter my fourth tangent here. And like, I do think that, you know, this is going to sound so like, I don't care if you're yellow or what, or purple or brown or all people are the same, like all that bullshit, right? Like that a certain group loves to say. But like, I really do think that no matter who you are, you can talk sports with someone. And as a result, I want to be able to connect. I love connecting with people. I want to be able to connect with people, hear their stories, tell my stories, learn from each other. And sports is like my favorite vehicle for that.
If you found yourself advancing, because I like what you're describing, there's a reality sometimes of the industry that bloatedness that you're describing happens. If you're going to, if you as an ESPN, for example, if you're going to try to, if you're going to act like you cover everything and you can cover everything, but you have a concentrated number of people at the top covering it, holes present themselves. I will not name any names because I don't need to. But there are certain people very, very, very at the top of the sports pyramid who clearly don't know what they're talking about sometimes. And I like what you're saying because it sounds to me like you're presenting a new kind of model of like, you know, what matters in this is my joy and what this brings to me and what I can also bring to others. But also, I don't want to bring with me the old kind of traditional, if you don't know it, you can, you know, make it about character, make it about that team just wants it more. But the industry tends to promote that sort of thing. Because so I'm curious if you think, this was the next question I was going to ask you, maybe this relates to it, What is something that you that exists right now in sports media that you hope 20 years from now is no longer the case?
Okay, so I think the easy answer is people succeeding at a role and getting a bigger role and succeeding at that role and getting a bigger role. And something that gets lost in those ascents is actual mastery of a topic. So like me personally, I'm a professional grade elite level bullshitter. You give me five random words and I will write you a full presentation of how they're connected and what they mean. I will come up with an analogy. I can bullshit for days, man, but I don't want to be doing that for a living. Like Stephen A. Smith is so amazing. He is so talented. That guy came up muckraking before I was fucking born. He was a grinder.
He was a good sports writer.
Dude, what the fuck happened? He's so entertaining. And that's all that matters, right? Like, it didn't matter if you thought Blake Griffin or Carmelo Anthony was better, because his argument of it's so ridiculous that you could think Blake Griffin is better than Carmelo Anthony was fucking hilarious. So, like, that's what sold. And I think we're in a world, not to get too, like, Neil Postman amusing ourselves to death, like, not to get too far down that road. I'm a college kid. Come on.
This audience will appreciate that reference.
Everything's entertainment, politics, entertainment, the hospital, fucking entertainment. They got TVs and video games and Nintendo Switches. And, you know, if Iron Man and the Avengers come to visit you, you're probably not doing well. And like everything is entertainment, dude. And so, like, I wish that the commodification and higher valuation recently of niche outlets like Nick's Film School, like different places like that, where you can get real, not premium, like, oh, everyone at KFS, I don't get how they don't run an NBA team today, like level analysis where it's like, oh my God, these people. But like, realistically, I think there are front office executives who don't know as much about basketball as Benji and DJ and 99th Basketball, like the guys who do our film threads. Like, there are front office people who don't know more about basketball than those guys, but they networked and relationshiped their way to the top. And that's like a very real thing. That's how the world works. I guess my immature, naive take is I wish the world worked a little differently and things were a little more merit-based, because I do have faith in myself that in that kind of world, I could still rise to the top. And it would take a lot of hard work, and I'm nowhere near that yet. But I do think that I'm really good at a mix of the two. And I wish like kind of like having a some sort of knowledge and presenting it well, or having the knowledge itself, like those are two really important skills. And I think that we live in a world where people who are just good at presenting any sort of knowledge just get fed their notes before the show and then are entertaining. Like, tell me it's not the literal best that fucking JJ Redick and LeBron James made a show where they're like, we're just going to talk bullshit on clipboards for 2 hours and it's gonna be fucking awesome. Like, that's sick. More of that, and less of Chris Persiainen going on WFUV Sports's 3 hour radio show talking about the NHL. I love the Rangers, like, blindly, right? Like, Capo Caco is also Finnish and has type 1 diabetes. Whoa, that's my guy. But like, I don't know jack shit about how he plays the game of hockey, and I probably never will. I'm not gonna pretend. Well, you know, he's tough, and you can't teach tough.
He just wants it.
What the fuck does that mean? Like,
That has fallen off. That has definitely fallen off from when I was young, which I'm glad to see. And I, like you, I hope that there's more of that, because I think it not only impedes, you know, actual conversation from happening, but it's a literal. It obfuscates all these conversations that we could be having. Like, it's not just a waste in and of itself, but I'm always struck by like how much we could discuss, like you were saying, all the intersections of sports, economics, society, justice, like media, all the intersections. There's so much we can do with it. And there's so much time we waste on Blake Griffin versus Carmelo vibe.
What did LeBron have for breakfast? Why does that mean that Kawhi Leonard is going to the Lakers? Like, dude, get a life. Like, what the fuck are we doing? So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy also to shit on really successful people and be like, oh, I could do better. And you actually couldn't, because if you were traveling to 7 cities in 6 days, you'd be shitting yourself. But like, I think we should just promote doing the work and having proof that you've done the work, as opposed to showing that you can bullshit enough together to make it seem like you've done the work. Kendrick Perkins, just like right before we recorded this podcast, went on Twitter and quote tweeted Shannon Sharpe saying that Jalen Brunson's been inefficient this season. And he was like, I'm gonna stay quiet.
Or Shannon Sharpe, who said that?
Shannon Sharpe.
I'm just joking.
Said like, I will, you know, I'm a Bears fan. Shannon Sharpe said today that he was inefficient, and Perk quote tweeted him, and he was like, I'm just gonna quote my, I think it was his mom or grandma, like, God bless his heart, he doesn't know any better. And it's like, yes, correct, but that's on primetime television. If you told Shannon Sharpe to break down X's and O's for you on the gridiron, he is shitting on 99% of the football podcasters out there, shitting on them, because what they think they know, they've never experienced, or they have experienced it and they're not great at analyzing it. Like, whatever it is, Shannon Sharpe would shit on them. But because he's Shannon Sharpe and he's so fucking entertaining, he's talking about Jalen Brunson and the New York Knicks. Why? Like, if you get the topic, then do the homework. And if you're not, then just say, listen, I'm not going to pretend I've watched every Knick game this year, but am I wrong to have a concern about Jalen Brunson's inefficiency? Instead, it's like the fake it till you make it. Like, I know Brunson's been a little inefficient, and that's a concern in the playoffs. Knick fans are not concerned enough about his inefficiency. And then everyone gets upset with you. Like, no one is ever mad when someone prominent says, I don't really know about this topic. These are my takes. What do we think? It's when it's like Brian Windhorst, who is really, really good at what he does, really, really talented, and I think an underrated, actually no longer underrated after the Utah Jazz moment, because I think that finally got him the shine he deserved. A lot of people would hate on him. They're like, oh, he rides LeBron's coattails. It's like, well, you know how many fucking journalists have tried doing that? Why is he the one who does it the best? Something causes that. But now I think he's adequately seen as a great entertainer and analyst of basketball. But he was laughing on a show saying, you know, it's funny to me that Knick fans clamor for Deuce McBride to play because he'll help the defense. Like, really? That's who you think is going to help this team out? Yeah. And then that's the same guy who gets the notes before his on-air show, McBride averaging this and, oh, he's a great shooter, he's a great defender. Like, you didn't, no one has a problem with what you said the second time. It's that you were condescending the first.
So, speaking of the Knicks, and their very impressive end to a very impressive regular season yesterday, the Knicks are going to be facing either Philadelphia or Miami in the first round, both of whom present obviously different threats. I'm curious, and I don't know if your answer is different from one to the other, Chris, as a fan and as a media member, do you have a preference for who you would like to see the Knicks play?
I think the Knicks as a team should want to play the Miami Heat over the Philadelphia 76ers. As an NBA fan, as someone who has spent a lot of time watching the Knicks specifically, I also think the Heat are the better matchup for them. And it honestly has nothing to do with the storyline of like Knicks Heat rivalry. To me, it's all about why the Knicks defense is so good and the kind of unique threat that Philadelphia poses to that. So Buddy Hield was a really big acquisition for Philadelphia. And part of the reason for that is because Joel Embiid is having a fucking superhuman season. And part of that is his growth as a passer. Giannis and Randle are two guys on kind of like opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of how fans view them as passers, in terms of forwards that get the ball a lot. Giannis, oh, he's so natural and gifted, and Randle's such a slow processor. Those are two guys who need to take 3 to 4 dribbles in a straight line drive draw a second defender, then look up and make the read to the corner. Mm-hmm. They are reacting to what the defense gives them, which is great. Joel Embiid, I think, was the same way for a long time. This season, he's fucking making the read before it's there. And now he has the shooting personnel to make defenses really, really pay if they pack the paint. So for the New York Knicks, the big question is, where does OG Anunoby go? And a lot of people say, it's simple. You let OG Anunoby negate Tyrese Maxey, and then Embiid goes one-on-one in the paint, and you know, the supporting cast isn't good enough. They don't have to be fantastic for Buddy Hield to be good at making threes, for Nick Batum to be good at making open fucking threes. Like, I watched Joe Ingles hit like six threes at Madison Square Garden because every single time Drew or Giannis had the ball in the high post or at the top of the key, the Knicks sent two, one from either the one was the primary defender. The other was either from the corner or the weak side wing. And Joe fucking Ingles was open every single time. And I asked Tom Thibodeau post game, hey, Tom, you know, every time Giannis or Drew had the ball at the top of the key or in the high post, you sent a second defender either from the weak side or from the strong side corner, and it left Ingles open. It felt like all the baskets they made in the third quarter were threes, like you just said. Did you ever think about changing that?
No.
So, like,
is that literally his answer?
No. You know, you look at the, you know, you see how they, you know, they want to beat you. They want Giannis to, they want Giannis in the paint, and we're not, you know, I'm not going to let him beat me. You know, you let the other guys beat you, you know,
shit like that, right? Like, that's Tibbs, and that shit pays off. Like, there was a game this season against Cleveland where Okoro hit like three threes in the first half because they were leaving him open. Tibbs comes out in the second half and he's like, I bet that guy who's 3 for 3 finishes 3 for 7. And he fucking did. So, like, that can pay off with Isaac Okoro. Buddy Hield is going to make you pay. And so for Joel Embiid, if you put OG on Maxey, he's going to tear you to shreds in the high post, in the low post, anywhere inside. One center gets in foul trouble, boom. Precious Achiuwa is playing 20 minutes against a team that's going to out-rebound the hell out of him. I think Achiuwa could be a weapon against Miami and their second unit. So based on who the Knicks are, based on what makes them good at defense, I think you put Anunoby as a free safety against Philadelphia. You don't put him on either Embiid or Maxey. You use him as the helper. Yep. And that is like more strategy than I want the team to be doing for their fucking first round matchup. So, like, I think Miami, you can play them straight up. We know they won't play them straight up. We know Rozier is going to hit a million threes because they're going to double Jimmy. But other than that, who cares? You know what I mean? Like, I think it would be like either Knicks in six or Philadelphia in 6 or 7. And then against Miami, it would be like Knicks in 5 or Miami in 6 or 7. So the Knicks learned really, really well in the first round of the 2021 playoffs that having an all NBA creator and no other creators of any kind does not work. But this time, the second and third best players for the team are not the corpses of Derrick Rose and Taj Gibson. It's OG Anunoby and Isaiah Hartenstein. Oh, and they have Dante DiVincenzo. And they have Deuce McBride, who can hit the open three. Like, guys are going to be able to play off of Brunson's gravity. And if you watched yesterday against the Chicago Bulls, Deuce McBride played like 9 minutes before overtime happened. And the Brunson McBride backcourt pairing like didn't happen much at all. And so maybe Thibodeau's giving that a shot, going back to Deuce just being the Brunson stopgap when he's out, because Brunson's going to be playing so much in the playoffs. Yeah. But I also think Miami's a team that you can go Brunson McBride against and watch it pay off. So, like, I just think schematically for the Knicks and talent-wise, Miami's worse than Philadelphia. And based on the scheme that the Knicks would run against them, they're a more favorable matchup for New York than Philadelphia. The Sixers should scare anybody in the first round, and they did. That's why Milwaukee and Cleveland.
So I wanted to ask you about that. Over. I wanted to ask you about this with Cleveland specifically, because I find Milwaukee very boring and gray and sad right now.
Yeah, they name sucks.
There is a I have felt this with Doc Rivers teams, going back to his Philadelphia teams especially. Doc Rivers' recent teams seem to be talented, but there is a lack of joy. And this, I know we just talked about, like, you want to be able to give concrete analysis. This is all obviously from a distance. But as a fan, I'm saying my experience watching his teams, unlike his Celtic teams, unlike his Clipper teams, this could be about personnel more than anything. Like, it's not like since Doc took over in Milwaukee, they seem to have found a spark. Like, I think it's fair to say that has not happened. What happened to the end of the season, I think Giannis's injury just compounded the sense of malaise around them. But Cleveland, to me, is really intriguing because last year the Mavericks did a very shameless, I thought, tanking at the very, 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 very end of the season because they didn't think they were going to do much in the playoffs. They wanted to keep the draft pick that they were going to owe to the Knicks. And even though I thought it was shameless, shameful, both, I understand why they did it. Like,
yeah, yeah, I was going to say, if you were a fan of any other team, you would be like, damn, that was smart.
I'm not a Mavs fan. I understand why they did it. There was a benefit to it. So whatever I think of it, it's not like it was a crazy action. What does Cleveland gain as a team, and particularly as a franchise that is trying, I think, I haven't heard yet that they've given up. If they still have any sense of Donovan Mitchell as someone that they can convince to stay, and your head shaking is going to get maybe where I was going to go with that. If they think there's any chance Mitchell can stay, it makes no sense for them to quit at the end and drop down so they can beat Orlando. Like, that's going to make them stay. But if there's more going on maybe behind the discussion of the scenes, for example, if the organization has realized, okay, we don't think we can keep this guy, then I can see reasons why it's advantageous for them to say, all right, we're going to lose Mitchell probably either way. But they're not a team who, like, well, once he's gone, they're blowing it up and rebuilding. They have a lot of other still nice players still there. Does Cleveland gain by thinking, all right, we'll drop down, we beat Orlando, at least we have that going for us. Yeah, we trade Mitchell, but the guys who we keep have now had that experience of winning together. So that explains maybe why they did it, because otherwise I don't see what the potential benefit is to them literally beyond winning the first round, which you're not the Kings. You're not just trying to win a series to get a monkey off your back. You won a finals 8 years ago. Your fans are not the Timberwolves fans. They're not just desperate to see one success. Did you think yesterday was Cleveland tanking?
So I'm going to say three scenarios. Two of them happen in real life. The first is going to connect to both. And this is like my corny way of explaining what's going on down in the great state of Ohio. I'm in a class and I have a C minus a month into the class, and the deadline to drop a class before it goes on your transcript as a withdrawal is in a week. And tomorrow there's a huge test. And I tell my teacher, Hey, teach, if I don't get a 100 on this test, this class is just too hard and I'm going to drop it. Mm-hmm. And then I don't study. And like, there's scenario number one,
okay,
setting up, dropping the class and painting someone else as the bad guy, because I didn't try hard enough in that class. So here's scenario number two. This happened in real life. Dan Gilbert told the media he thinks Donovan Mitchell is going to re-sign.
Right.
Scenario number three, this happened in real life. Reports recently came out that Donovan Mitchell is going to ask out if the Cleveland Cavaliers don't reach the NBA Finals. And this is not if you watch Curb, like, oh, I had a hunch, you know, but claiming the hunch after the thing happened. No. I was told the day before that report dropped, that exact report. Okay. And then the next day, someone else put it out there. It's clearly a thing. Okay. To me, that is Gilbert and Mitchell acting like competing presidential candidates, trying to set each other up, trying to fake build each other up and put each other down and give each other an excuse to shit on each other in the process. Like, I think it's all phony. I also think that for Donovan Mitchell, someone who is kind of saying, like, hey, if we don't make it to the finals, I want out because this team didn't do enough to be serious about winning. Well, first of all, it's a little bit of a lack of self-awareness because of how many assets they used on him, but he didn't ask to go there. That's really a big part of it. They thought Mobley was Tim Duncan, and I'm not going to go as far as my pal Mr. Bontemps, who has compared him to Derek Favors recently, high draft pick who has not panned out.
Tyson Chandler maybe is a better current comp.
I said last year Mobley was 2 years and 20 pounds away. Now I would say I should have said he was 2 years or 20 pounds away. Either way, we're 1 year and 18 pounds away. So they miscalculated like shit what was going on inside their own building. That's embarrassing. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they are going to lose Donovan Mitchell. I think Bickerstaff and Mitchell are both gone before game one next season. And maybe they keep Bickerstaff and then fire him midseason. I just don't. Who cares, right? And let's be honest. And I think that with that situation, if you think a guy who's willing to say, this is what I was saying earlier, if you think a guy who's willing to say, hey, if we don't make it to the finals, you guys are unserious and I'm leaving, is happy about what they did yesterday, if you think he thinks that was smart, like a lot of Knicks fans were like, you're so stupid. Tibbs is so stupid for trying to win against the Bulls. They have nothing to play for. We should be playing the Pacers. Like, why are we trying to win? And then like 4 years ago, these are the people who are like, oh, hired another asshole general manager, Leon Rose, who's going to promise us stars and never win anything. Like, dude, fucking pick one. Yep. And if the Knicks naturally lost that game, I would have been like, wow, that's great for them. But
you would take it, but you're not looking for it.
You don't try to lose it. I think
also, I think like what you're saying, and this is the difference with the Knicks and the Cavs. If I'm the Cavs and I haven't won a playoff series without LeBron since 1993, and I care about that, let's say, then I just want to get to the I just want to win a series. And so I'll take Orlando and not worry about what follows. And the Knicks a year ago, I could see a Knicks fan a year ago thinking, you know, I haven't seen my team win a series in a while. I just want to see them win a series. But the Knicks' ambitions, reflected by their play, have risen. I don't care so much about getting an easy win in the first round as I care about, well, now they've got home court in the second when they play Milwaukee or Indiana. I care more about that because I think this team is aiming for something, you know, something high, not let's get to the first round and win a series and then we can pat ourselves on the back, you know, when draft night rolls around because we won a playoff series. Like there's a little bit, there's more of that energy I feel like coming from Cleveland certainly than there is from the Knicks. And you're right. I was seeing yesterday, I was shocked by that with everything you saw happening, the opportunity to get the two seed, the opportunity to get home court through the first two rounds. And people are like angling for Indiana. Let's say the Knicks got Indiana and won. What does that prove to you about this team that you didn't already know?
If they beat
Milwaukee or Miami, I learned something about them. If they beat Orlando or Indiana, I don't really learn anything about them.
Andrew Claudio, my producer at Knicks Film School, made a point that the Knicks have gotten where they are right now, like putting both feet on the pedal and pushing it as hard as they can. Mm-hmm. Don't stop now. Take the momentum in the playoffs. And I also think if I had to bet, if I had $100 betting chip and you said I had to put it on something related to Mitchell's thoughts on what the Cavs did, I think he thinks it's pathetic. Like I don't think he's like peeved by it. I think he thinks it's like actually fucking pathetic that they did that. He wants to be part of a team with Heat culture or with Tibbs culture. Yeah. You know, funnily enough, I can see a different Florida team being the one that trades for him this summer if they think they're close enough. But
that'd be great. Be interesting after they face off. But he would be I would find it to be just a unbelievably fun fit to see him in that backcourt, especially if it's like him and Suggs. Because with that front line, you know,
send Anthony Black and send picks galore and send the salary and whatever, and like that could be really cool.
Anthony, whatever you got to do.
Yeah, Anthony,
Imagard.
Anthony, Cole Anthony, Anthony Black. Mm-hmm. Fucking is Gary Harris still salary on that team?
Yeah, like, is he still up this year? I think Harris.
Maybe it expires. That's I know he's on the team. It's more about does the
yeah. I'm trying to see.
So I'm not trying not to Shannon Sharp it here. But basically, Gary like
Harris is off the books after this season.
Okay, all right. So, whatever to that. But like. If that could work, I think Houston will be after him. I think the Knicks will be after him. I think DiVincenzo working next to Brunson was proof of concept for them that two guards that aren't known as on-ball elite defenders like can work together if one of them is a fucking offensive supernova. If both are offensive supernovas, what does that look like? Let's find out. So like that's probably the logic there. I think the Knicks would be okay letting a team outbid them for Mitchell because they never want to overpay.
Yeah.
It's honestly like I would say if the Knicks overpay for Mitchell, it's because Dolan was like, dude, we got to get this shit rolling. I think, you know, the Grayson Allen extension says that they're not blowing it up. I think the Knicks are still waiting on 2025 for Devin Booker. I've been saying that since 2020.
Okay.
March 2020, I wrote in for Sports Illustrated, I think, that for the first time that the Knicks will want Devin Booker. That he's the golden goose of the Leon Rose front office. And that's going to be a thing whenever that's a thing. But, you know, Mitchell's really good. He actually changed my opinion on him this season. I've always thought Mitchell was overrated. I've always thought Mitchell, I've had people ask me before, how could I not have Donovan Mitchell top 10? Like, what does he have to do? What else does he have to do? That was like, win anything ever. Not be my height. Things like that, right? And like I understand that those seem reductive and like narrative based, but that's how you talk about guys that are fucking top 10 is like they need to pass every benchmark. And he did not. I did not have him top 15. I barely had him top 20 last season. And now I think he's like easily a top 15 player. Like definitely easily a top 15 player. This season was fucking nuts from him. Like he was in MVP talks for a hot minute for a reason.
Yeah, he was. These things do matter. I think not to shock anyone, but if Michael Jordan were 6'2", he would not have had the same career that he did at 6'6". Last question for you, Chris, going to the Western Conference. Just a strict, it could break down this way. Let's say the Pelicans beat the Lakers in the 7-8 game, and let's say the Warriors beat the Kings in the 9-10, and we get another LeBron Laker versus Warriors playoff game. These are two of the, this is probably the greatest player of the last, depending on how far you want to rank them, 20 to forever years, and probably maybe the end of the greatest dynasty that we've seen in the last 10. Who would you, as a non-fan of either team, but as an NBA fan, as just someone who likes the stories and likes to watch great games, would you rather see Golden State advance at the Lakers' expense, or would you rather see the Lakers advance at the Warriors' expense?
Oh, great question. I thought you were going to ask who I thought would win. I would rather... Okay. I think it would be really funny and make old people angry if the Lakers made a deep playoff run and LeBron had more shit like that on his resume.
Yeah.
But conversely and perversely, is it if Steph makes a deep playoff run, is he like a lockety lock for being a top 10 player ever? Yes. So LeBron, whatever happens this year, no matter whether he wins the championship or gets out in the first round, the people that think he's the second best player ever are going to say he's the second best player ever. And the people who think he's the best player ever are not going to change their mind. So I think there's more of an impact on the discourse if Curry wins. So I would rather see the Warriors proceed forward, also in part because I fucking love Draymond Green, and even though as much as I say, and I'm surprised I didn't say this earlier, I hate that the NBA is covered like the WWE.
That's a thing.
But like, Draymond has a future in the WWE.
Draymond has a prison in the WWE.
So like, that's a thing. And also something about Warriors fans having a literal civil war and being like, Steve Kerr knows what's best for the young players. Steve Kerr doesn't know what's good if it hit him in the face, and he needs to play Kuminga and Moody more. And both Kuminga and Moody being good as a result of Kuminga going to Shams and being like, this motherfucker ruined my early career and lost me tens of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. Something about Kuminga being the team's Iguodala this year would just hit me the right way. And so as someone who likes to watch funny things happen, but ultimately is a sucker for a good story, I think the better story is if the Warriors advance at the Lakers' expense.
I agree. I think the Warriors are a more interesting story if they win, and I think the Lakers are a more interesting story if they lose.
How special is Kevon Looney being like the poster boy for the running backs aren't worth any money community, like of the NBA? Like, fucking just get good players at every position and then throw fucking Mike Breen out there at center and watch them win a championship. Like, that's like, how special is Kevon Looney? That guy's actually good at basketball. If he went to like the Kings in a year, and was like a great backup for them, like, he would actually, like, no one would know what team he plays for. Like, he would just disappear off the face of the earth. And that's awesome that he's so essential to their runs. Someone's got to do the job, and he has done it well.
They asked him to do something, and he did it. And he thought, yeah, he has done it well. Chris Persianen, do you have anything to tell our listeners to look out for as far as podcasts, future places we might see you? God forbid the written word, if such a thing should ever exist in the world. Anything to look out for from you?
If you want the company you work for to create things for people to look out for me, I'm graduating college in a month and am for hire. Places where you can evaluate my work are the WFUV Sports YouTube channel, where playoff post-game reports will be posted for as many rounds as the Knicks are in the playoffs. The All Things NBA from A to Z podcast presented by Ball is Life. We have a new show with a new sponsor that is live weekly talking NBA playoffs. It's 30 minutes every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. We give you our best bets, our best analysis. We put 6 NBA picks in yesterday and went 6-0. On spreads, on what I call the last day of school, which is where all the bullshit goes down. And 6-0 on that kind of day, I think, shows what we are as a trio. And I also do think that Knicks Film School, especially if you're a Knicks fan listening to this, whether I'm on the shows or not, is the best place to get Knicks analysis, whether it's pregame or postgame or my study hall show on the weekend. So lots of places you can find me. Twitter.com/Chris Persianen. It's a lot of vowels where they shouldn't be, as JJ Redick said. So that'll be linked somewhere, and you can find me there, and that'll send you to where else you can find me. Thanks so much for maybe not enjoying, but tolerating my ranting and tangents. And I hope everyone listening has a great day.
All right. Thank you so much, Chris, everybody. See you next episode. Peace.